This episode of Dean Bakari's Meaningful Show is brought to you by Flashbooks, where you can get best-selling business and self-improvement book summaries that you can read or listen to in under 20 minutes. To learn more and get started for just a buck today, visit www.getflashnotes.com. Welcome to the Meaningful Show podcast, where every single week we work to bring you an inspiring insight, idea, or interview to help you live better, work better, and be better both in life and in business. Brought to you by MeaningfulHQ.com, we've got one very simple goal here on this show, and that is to help you do more of what matters and less of what doesn't. I'm your host, Dean Bakari, and if you're ready, then I'm ready. So let's get into it. Hey, what's up, folks? It's Dean Bakari. Welcome back to the show. I have a guest here with me today. His name is Jay Papazan, who is the co-author with Gary Keller of literally one of my all-time favorite self-improvement books called The One Thing. You may have heard me mention it a time or two at least here on the show. Again, that's The One Thing, the surprisingly simple truth behind extraordinary results. And today, Jay's here to talk with us a little bit about some of the big ideas from the book. So, Jay, welcome to the show and thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me, Dean. I'm thrilled to talk today.
Absolutely. So, talk to me a little bit about, first of all, God knows how many times I've gifted this book to people.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. Absolutely. The best possible compliment to a writer.
I love it. I love the book. It's beautifully put together, not just written, but also aesthetically speaking, just the pages, the physical hard copy is really, really well written and really well designed. I love it.
Big shout out to, we have on staff, we have a lady named Caitlin McIntosh, credited on the cover. She is an exceptional designer, and the book actually won 12 industry awards for the design. So I'm super proud of the work she did on that.
Wow. Well, yeah, it pops. The cover definitely pops, everything you guys did inside of it as well. So let's talk about the book itself, though. Why'd you guys write it? What brought you to the point of saying, okay, we're going to write about this one thing?
You know, it was in the late 2000s, we were working on a course for, you know, Gary's real estate company, Keller Williams. And, you know, we had a course finished. At that time, I was leading our university. And I remember he said, this is great content. I'm going to take it home, you know, for the weekend and see if I can maybe write kind of a fun introduction to it. And I'm paraphrasing. But I remember he came back the next week and he had written a short essay, maybe 10, 12 pages called The Power of One. And, you know, I've been in publishing now for close to 20 years, first to HarperCollins Publishers and then becoming, you know, a self-published author and then working with Gary. And like my instincts when I read that, having worked with Gary, you know, for 8 or 9 years at that point were, wow, this is it. This is his big idea. And I just remember sitting down and saying, this is a book. This is very much a book. And I felt like as an author, this was something that was completely concentric with who he was. It's absolutely how he has achieved, I think, the grand portion of his success. He's built the number one training company, the number one real estate company in the world.
Yeah, interject here just for a second. For those of you who don't know about real estate, you guys are listening. Keller Williams is the number one real estate company in the United States. Am I right?
In the world now.
Wow. Okay. So these folks, I mean, this is no joke. They really did use the formula. They're not just saying a bunch of stuff and not actually following their own advice. This is, from my understanding, an approach built upon, you know, what you guys actually did.
That's exactly right. I mean, Gary's approach became the hypothesis, and we spent close to 5 years working on the research to back it up. And, you know, there were some parts of his hypothesis that worked for him that we did not put in the book because research did not support it working for other people. But it definitely, we felt like it was the driving thing. Gary's a smart guy. He's a hardworking guy. But the thing that truly distinguishes him and his company is their ability to identify the number one priority and focus on it. And that's what this book is about, is if you operate in your priorities, then, you know, Gary ultimately, and I believe too, that you'll live a life of no regrets.
Love it.
And that's what we all want in the end.
Absolutely. So let's talk about the focusing question. What's the one thing you can do such that by doing it, everything else will be easier or unnecessary? That's my screensaver, by the way.
Oh, I love that. That's great.
So
that's the one thing. We ask the question, when someone puts down this book, what's the one outcome, the thing that we want them to change in their behavior? And we all agreed that we want them to ask that question. And so if you had the book, you could flip it over and like, what do we put on the back instead of promotional quotes and stuff? We put the question because we really wanted that to be the thing that people just took from the book. So I love that it's your screensaver. To answer your question, where did that come from? I believe we tell this tale in the book, but the short form would be, you know, Gary, you know, he's building this company. Every week he's coaching with his top business people. And I don't know, Dean, if you've got a business coach or not. I've got one. And the rhythm is something like, whether it's every week or every month, at the end of your meeting or call, you agree what's going to happen between now and the next call. And they would come up with the three or four things they were going to get done to move the business forward until the next call. And Gary noticed a pattern that they would do some of the things, but rarely did people do the most important thing. And they certainly didn't do it consistently. And so he started forcing them to narrow their focus. You know, like, Dean, if you can only get three things done this week to move the ball forward, what are those going to be? Great. And then you'd come back the next week and say, hey, I did two and three. I didn't get around to number one. And it was really out of parental kind of frustration that he actually first articulated, if you can only get one thing done this week, one thing to move the ball forward, what is that going to be? And he only held people accountable to one action per week. And the shocking thing was, is not only did they do the thing that they said they were going to do, because frankly, there's no place to hide. They know they're going to get asked about it.
Yep.
And they can't say, but I did this instead.
Yeah,
they just have to say, no, I didn't do it. And that brings a whole other level of accountability to ourselves.
Absolutely.
And the other thing that struck him really crazily is not only did they do the most important thing, they tended then to necessarily do the other stuff. And their results went through the roof. And so it's really been over about 15 years of refinement and in the process of writing this book that we articulated the focus in question. It's just, it's meant to be a powerful question to give you a powerful answer.
Yeah. Yeah. And it seems like, you know, it really allows you to drill down on the highest leverage activity that you need to do, which oftentimes, like you said, as a byproduct kind of takes all the other things into account as well. You end up doing, you know what I mean?
Oh, I mean, that is absolutely the design. You hit the nail on the head. You know, if you break it down, you know, it's what's the one thing, right? Not two or three. So it's narrow your focus. I can do, and I hear a lot of people say should, would, right? Or could, but it's can. We want people to get into action.
Stop shitting all over yourself.
Right. Oh, yeah. I always quote Shel Silverstein, all the woulda, coulda, shouldas all ran away and hid from one little did. And such that by doing it just says that any outcome of this action has to be some multiple, right? And the size of that is everything's easier and necessary. So in effect, you're looking for the longest lever you have in your life at that current moment. And that's going to be your highest outcome activity to get to your goals. It's a little bit, you have the 80-20 principle that we cover in the book. Mm. You know, but instead of the 20%, what's the one thing that'll get you your biggest impact?
Very nice. Very nice. So from sort of a broader life level perspective, two questions. So first, what would you say your one thing is?
You know, there's a lot of different levels to that question. And so I think professionally, the thing that I have been drawn to my whole life as a hobbyist and as a professional is obviously writing. Tried to write my first book when I was like 12 years old, off The Hobbit on a typewriter, right? And wrote stories all through high school, went and, you know, worked in bookstores, studied writing. But it really took me almost 30 years to get around to becoming an author instead of a bookseller or an editor or a writing teacher. So it was a little bit of a meandering path. I think that the second half to the answer, though, so there's this creative person that I'm fundamentally know that I'm driven to be. But what's more important is why I do it.
Right.
And I think that has really got to do with my family. and totally cheesy, but you know, I know that I will strive to be my best and do my best in my profession because of them. And you know, the story I kind of tell around this is, it was during the real estate crisis, and I was asked to help an executive write a book called Shift Commercial. It was a book on commercial real estate. Mm-hmm. I was very annoyed to be taken out of my comfort zone into commercial. I argued that, you know, there's only 50,000 commercial agents. There's not even a market large enough to support a book. And I remember coming home and telling my wife, I was like, you know, I'm just going to interview this guy. I'm going to relay what he says really powerfully. I'm going to let it be his book. And she looked at me, and she's my partner, and she holds me accountable to being my best. And she said, you know, you tell us, your family, that you're an author, but it sounds a lot like you're about to mail this one in.
Oh.
Oh, you know, body blow, you know, and, you know, so I rallied. I was like, God bless you, you know. Mm-hmm. And the book did not sell a lot because there wasn't a market for it. I was right about that. But it did win an industry award as one of the top three books in our industry that year. Wow. And I'm probably proudest of that because it's the book I least wanted to write. But I got really clear that I'm trying to raise my children to be their best. And the only way to do that is for me to consistently give my best effort. Right. So I have to live in integrity. And the way to have the best possible marriage with my wife is to continually earn her respect and never take that for granted. And so that's a big one.
That's a big one. It powers everything.
It's kind of cheesy, but when I really need to get motivated to do my best work, it's about them.
Love it. Love it. So how would you advise someone, Jay, if someone said to you, you know, this one thing idea sounds great and all, but you know, what do I do if I don't know what my one thing is? How do I figure that out? Let's say, let's call it in the professional world.
Okay.
Right? Let's say somebody's got a bunch of different passions and, you know, they're not really sure quite which avenue to pursue. How would you advise someone to figure that out for themselves?
Well, I think that it's a little bit of trial and error. I mean, my first thing would be like, well, welcome to the club. I mean, statistically, right. I think when you talk about purpose and meaning, there's only a very small percentage of people who seem to be really clear about that.
Yeah.
So it takes an effort. So you have to focus on it to understand it. And I think the exploration of where our gifts and interests lie, hopefully we know the direction of our interests. Like I can ask my son, and right now at 11 years old, he's very clear that he wants to do some sort of work that involves video games, right? And I'm like, cool. Do you, you know, and I'm trying to, you know, as a parent guide that, do you think you want to be coding them? Are you going to be doing the art? Are you going to be doing the story? And, you know, and he said, like this morning, we had this conversation. He goes, well, maybe the story. And I was like, great. So what do you think you need to be working on today to be good at that later? And he's like, well, you know, I need to probably pay more attention in our creative writing workshop. Like, that's a great answer because I think story matters a lot, doesn't it? Blah, 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 blah. So right. As adults, we can play that same game. You know, get a glass of wine on, and, you know, after the kids are asleep, get a glass of tea on a Saturday morning, cup of coffee, find a quiet spot, get a journal out and say, what are the things that I'm truly the most passionate about? The things that I would do if no one was going to pay me to do. And what are the causes that I feel are most important in my life? So if I look back at the end of my life and I made a difference there, what would be most meaningful? And just start trying on different combinations, and it's going to be unique to everyone. You know, it's underwater basket weaving to save the whales. Awesome. But if that gets you going, you might be able to change the world.
Yeah.
And don't judge it because it is inherently not competitive and personal all at once.
Yeah.
So if you never tell anyone what it is, but people get really caught up in both the professional sense and the big world sense, why and the what. And I just say, pick a direction and start going down it. And then ask the question, is this really what I thought it was going to be? And if it's not, then quickly go to something else.
Yeah. Yeah.
And,
I think being afraid to quit and try something else is also a biggie. Like you just kind
of it's not the 50s. You know, you don't have to be a company man or woman and just stick with it and be loyal. I definitely think that there are some millennials who are a little too focused on acquiring skills and not a career. So there's a middle ground there.
Absolutely.
Where you can say, you know, I want to have a great career, not just a great year. So what are the things that I should be focusing on that will bring long-term joy to my work? And most people who haven't done a lot of work don't know what that answer is. So that's normal. So just go out and try it and examine it and keep asking the question. I think that's the only way to get clear about it and know that it'll change over time. Mine has evolved. I mean, obviously, my big motivation about my wife and kids couldn't have existed before 1997 when I got married and met my wife, right?
Right, right,
so,
yeah.
But something was driving me, so it's liable to change a little bit, so don't rush to the tattoo artist when you figure it out.
Love it, love it. Now I'd like to, if we could, fire off some of my favorite few big ideas from The One Thing, Jay, and see if you could go ahead and just expound on them as we
Absolutely.
Go down the list. Sound good?
Sure.
All right, so the first one is, and I love this one, it's one of my favorites, success is sequential, not simultaneous.
Wow. Yeah, that's a big one. And, you know, so the central theme metaphor that we use in the book is of a domino run. Mm. And we created that, one, because it made sense to the book, but also because one of the first objections people have to the idea of one thing is, Jay, Gary, there's never just one thing. There's so many things we have to do. And it's true. And so the metaphor goes, you know, if you've ever lined up dominoes so that by knocking over one, you can get many to fall down, then you understand one of the central goals of the book is to get us to do a better job of aligning the dominoes in our life so that we can do fewer things for more output. Mm. And so you've got that idea. And so the sequence is in the dominoes. And, you know, I'm trying to boil a lot of ideas down together because you came at this sideways, which is great. This is very invigorating for me. So when I think of this fundamentally, I think that this book is about identifying the one activity that's going to drive you forward and then ultimately making that thing a habit.
Yeah.
And for lots and lots of reasons that we'll probably go into, we're always best served if we're trying to establish one habit at a time.
Absolutely.
And so when we say really sequential, you become, like, let's just say you're a writer. So you become really good at getting up early in the morning to write, and that becomes a habit. And once it's a habit, it's easy to do. And then you become really good at adding the next part of getting up and writing. Mm. And so it's actually writing early in the morning is two new behaviors. So do them sequentially, and you'll be a lot more likely to be successful. And so that's what I look at. I look at people, and you hear about them on these other podcasts who have all these rituals in the morning. And the ones that are really doing it, I would argue, if you really looked under the hood, they probably added one, did it, and then added another, figured it out, and then add another. They didn't just jump out and do six things at once.
Absolutely. Yeah, it'd be impossible. Impossible. Yeah, that's thinking back, you know, every habit that I've ritualized in my own life has only, it's happened sequentially. It's happened
right.
One at a time. The metaphor that I like
You've
kind
of got to make a stand, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
I think I was talking to Gretchen Rubin, who wrote Better Than Before, and she's just such a brilliant lady. And I'm going to misquote her, but I think something like 74% of our day is governed by our existing rituals and
habits. Yeah.
Yeah. And some of them are bad, some of them are good, but it's really hard to take a bad habit and flip it to a good one. So pick your battles and make a stand around that until it's set, and then move on to the next one.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So in the book, you guys say that there are certain lies that society has been led to believe about success. And one of those lies being that the key to success is balance. In the book, you guys say, to achieve an extraordinary result, you must choose what matters most and give it all the time that it demands. This requires getting extremely out of balance in relation to all other work issues. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, I love this chapter. I remember really pouring through the research over about 3 or 4 weeks. There's so much to unwind here, but fundamentally, the idea of work-life balance is a very modern idea. It doesn't even show up in the literature until the 80s. And you know, in articles, newspapers, anything, it's a very fundamentally new idea that we need this balance.
Right.
And so when I'm speaking or giving a speech for a keynote or whatever, and it's conducive to that, I usually ask people, will you please stand up? Okay, great. Now stand on one foot. And so you got a whole room of 500 people balancing on one foot, right? And I'll say, quick question, are you balanced or are you balancing? And everyone says balancing. And I thank them and get them to sit down. And I said, that's the difference. It's a subtle difference. But we've been sold that there's this place we get to arrive at called balance, where everything's in order. It's a destination, right? That's just out of reach. Mm. And that's how people talk about it. And it's just not reality. Balance is something we do. It's a verb. And we have to do it in a very special way if you're really on the path to extraordinary success. And that's what this book is about. So first lesson is, it's an activity that we have to do, not a destination. And that's just a bill of goods, that whole idea of the destination.
Right. I like that. That's a really good distinction.
Oh, yeah. And it's a fun thing to get people to live at. You can get your kids to do that. You know, are you balanced or are you balancing? Right.
I like that.
And so just realize that life is a balancing act. It's something you have to do all the time. So we divided your work into our work life and our stuff that makes up your life. Mm-hmm. And the fundamental thing is, if you really practice the one thing approach, especially at work, you're going to pay the most attention to the thing that gets you the most results, sometimes painfully, to the exclusion of many other things. There will be little brush fires burning in your business, but because you're doing the right thing, you will ignore them until the end of the day, right?
Right.
And that feels like you're out of balance a lot. And if you interview people who are having businesses, I mean, I just was texting some friends that whose business grew, their gross revenue grew from by 123% to almost 50 million this last year. And I was congratulating them. And, you know, 50 million, that's a lot of revenue,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And so I was like, you clearly sandbagged it the year before, you know? But you've got this kind of thing going on where at work, you've got to be all in on your most important activity if you want those kinds of results.
Absolutely.
But you can't take that approach with your health, your relationships, your spirituality. Yeah. If you neglect those things for too long, you know, the wife and kids may not be waiting for you when you get home. the really hard reality, your health may disappear really quickly.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it's always an event, right? It's this moment, right, that people are like shocked, like, what do you mean I've not been coming home on time? Or what do you mean I'm going to have a heart attack? You know, and so you have to actively, we call it counterbalance. And so if I'm all in at work and maybe, you know, we have a big conference coming up in 2 weeks and I'll be away from my family for like 5 days. Well, I have blocked off 3 vacation days on the end of that. And I'm probably going to pull my kids out of school because I'm going to get back into that as fast as I can, relax myself and be present with my family after being absent. I'm going to counterbalance actively.
So it's almost like kind of like buffering. Setting up a buffer on both ends. If you're, for instance, getting ready to go all in on something, like one thing I like to do is, anytime I'm going to do a lot of heavy traveling, especially if it's work related, I'll just take off a day or two before I go for my traveling thing. And I'll make sure that I take off a day or two after I come back. So that way I can really make sure that I'm fully present for my family and we're really enjoying as much of that time as we can.
High five, dude. I love the part about the front end. I've always focused on the back end. I love that you're actually bookending the known events. And you might do that like, all right, so I know that it's the holiday season, Thanksgiving. Mm-hmm. Instead of dieting after all of this, why don't I really manage my diet so I can have a little fun when I'm traveling and eating all these big meals and then do it on the other side.
Absolutely.
That makes total sense. I love that approach.
So another myth here, let's talk about one more myth before we dive into some other stuff. And this one's about willpower. You guys say that willpower is always on will call. I like this one too, especially the way you guys explained it. Can you talk a little bit about that, Jay?
Sure. You know, there's this idea of where there's a will, there's a way. And it's absolutely a really amazingly true statement. And we all buy into it. You know, I can grit my teeth. I can just make this thing happen. Mm. But when we really started studying what that meant, this idea of self-control, right? It's this psychological factors is actually much more fleeting than any of us ever expected.
Yeah.
And so there's this superpower that we have, but it's not always available to us. And we have to understand the nature of that. So defining willpower as the mental energy, right? The cognitive stamina to say yes to what you need to do and also to say no to what you should avoid.
Yeah.
So in a diet, we use our willpower when we say yes to carrot sticks and hummus and no to the nachos. Both of those acts took willpower.
Yeah.
Willpower can be measured physiologically, because if I do a willpower related act and they measure the glucose in my bloodstream before and after, it will drop. And it will drop measurably. And so you literally are depleting the system every time you make a decision. And so there's the two big concepts. Okay, so there's now you've realized the thinkers in the crowd are like, whoa, is this related to nutrition? Yes, it is, right?
Yep.
That our willpower in some ways is related to our ability to have energy to think. So our brains are actually 1/50th of our body mass and use 1/5th of all the energy we consume. It's like a Hummer. So
that's a huge, huge idea, by the way, which really stuck with me. I think you guys wrote about that in the book, either that or I read about it as well in another book called Willpower, which I'm not sure if you've heard of. It's literally titled just Willpower.
I'm looking at my to read shelf because what I did is I boycotted a lot of those books while we were writing them. And I'm still like, sadly, I still haven't read The Power of Habit, right? Because I boycotted
it. Oh, gosh. I was thinking about that earlier when you were talking about habits, because that's one of my favorite books as well.
It's on my must-read in the first quarter of this year. I've got a little shelf of just those books, so it will be read shortly. But I boycotted it because it came out about 6 months before us, or I did not want it to. I didn't want to unintentionally plagiarize. We read a lot of the same original research, and I just was respecting.
Gotcha.
I think his name is Duhigg.
Yeah, Charles Duhigg.
I wanted to respect his work. Anyway, long story short, I tell people, think of your brain a little bit like a really old cell phone. You know, the one that you wake up in the morning and it's got a really solid charge, but you kind of keep a charger in the car and one by your desk because you're always a little worried that it's going to go red on you.
Yeah.
That's really kind of how our brain works. And it's very fragile, right? So every decision counts. And the one that kind of solidifies it, there was a study of the Israeli parole system. Do you want me to dive into that?
Sure, yeah, go for it.
So basically, the Israeli, they did a study of 1,100 cases over 1 year. It was like 40% of all the cases. It was Ben-Gurion University in Stanford. And basically, the judge's day is three sessions. It's a random docket. So they go for 2 hours. They have a break where they're given a snack, like a Hobbit breakfast or something. Mm-hmm. They go for 2 hours, just every 13 minutes on average, making a decision, a big willpower decision. Does this human being get denied family and freedom, or does this convicted whatever get released on society, right? Yeah. It's a big decision.
Yeah.
And then you go for a late lunch, and then they have 2 hours to end the day. And when they graphed their research, it was shocking. And if you were first in line for the morning session, you had about a 65% chance of getting parole. And very rapidly over the course of 2 hours, it dropped all the way to zero.
It's crazy.
The judges would fuel up. They would have their mid-morning snack. If you were first in line for the second session, it was back up in the high 60s, and it would quickly drop to the teens before going to zero, right? There was a little bit of a plateau where you had about a 10% chance, right?
Right.
And then you get to the afternoon, and we've all felt like after kind of your heavy lunch or whatever.
A little slump, yeah.
Oh, boom, like that 2:30 in the afternoon, you want to crawl under your desk. Well, it showed up here. Again, first in line, 60 to 65%, and then it dropped. It just craters on its way to zero very fast. And so you look at that, and what you know is, when you have no willpower, it does not mean you make a bad decision. It does mean you will go to your default mode, kind of the easy button.
Right, right.
And what's clear from this is that the default mode for a parole judge is go back to jail.
Put him in jail.
Yeah. So my joke on this is justice isn't blind, it's hungry. Right. And I usually challenge people. So if you know what your one activity is and you know that you should make it a habit, are you going to make that habit in the afternoon, in the middle of the day, or the morning when you hear all this? And then the entire audience will start mumbling, the morning.
Right.
And the reason is, if you know it's the thing that matters most, right, it's you're practicing to be an Olympian, right? You're going to get up early in the morning and swim, because that's when you have the willpower to do it every day.
Yeah.
And it's not about how much you did in one day. It's that you did it every day for 4 years that makes the biggest difference.
Yes.
And I had a guy walk out of the audience in a sales convention, and he said, ha, 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 you know, I'm going to start making my sales calls at the end of the day when they have no willpower. And I was like, okay, you're like my kids. You're trying to find the exception. Right. And my question back to him, and I just said, do you think that your customers need willpower to say yes? And he was like, I said, all right, good. You do the activity that most aligns with your success when you're most likely to do it. And on the days that you don't want to do it, you'll have willpower to make you do it. And that means you're going to do it in the morning. And if you study successful people, and Dean, I'm sure you listen to a lot of these podcasts and have it show up on yours. Really successful people have a great day before they get to work.
Yes, absolutely. They get up
early, they exercise, they eat well, maybe they meditate or journal. There's a lot that they know is core to their success that they're going to ensure happens, and it happens in the morning.
Yes.
I read a stat that people who are high net worth millionaires get up on average 3 hours before they have to go to work.
Yeah.
And I know a lot of people who show up at the office with their hair still wet from the shower, right?
Yeah.
And I used to be one. I was a writer. Yeah. I was a night owl.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's you. When I first, because the idea of establishing a solid morning routine is something that's, you know, prevalent in self-help literature. And I remember when I first came across it when I was graduating college, I was like, you know what? If all these people that are insanely successful are doing this, I'm going to do it too.
Yeah.
I'm going to role model that. And, you know, shortly thereafter, I kind of established the habit of getting up at first at 6 a.m. and then at 5:30 and then at 5 a.m. And that's been locked in ever since then, you know, for the past 7 years or so now. Every day, 5 a.m. And it's been so huge. I get so much done during that period. First, the preparation, right? Get up at 5 a.m., go to the gym. Then I do a little nature meditation type walk outside, journal for a little bit, read for at least 30 minutes, usually an hour, and then begin my time block for the day from 8 to 12, where I do my most important thing, my one thing, which I picked up from you guys.
Love that. And it's like if you were a professional athlete and you're about to play the Super Bowl, wouldn't you show up to the stadium a few hours before and warm up?
Oh, heck yeah. Yeah.
Right. So like you're showing up to your work time, right? When most people are hitting the office and you're fired up, your brain's clear, your focus is there, you're ready to go. And everybody else is like talking about Facebook and getting their coffee. And that is a massive edge when you think about 250 work days a year and how much more the people who started early are getting done. Just because they were ready to show up and work.
Absolutely.
Fully ready to show up and work. Fully besides charged. The benefits of the health of the things that you're doing in the morning.
Yep. So, Jay, as you probably know, around about this time, this is when people, you know, this is a little bit after mid-January, towards the tail end of the month, a lot of folks who set some really, really big New Year's resolutions are starting to forget about them.
Yeah.
So I think that goal setting to the now, the idea that you guys set forth, would be something that would be tremendously helpful for them if you just break it down real quick to remind folks.
Sure. I mean, I think we have it like in a footnote. I think every year like 100 million people do resolutions and 88 million fail.
Yeah, most people fail. Yeah.
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 And so don't be hard on yourself if that's you, right? But the other side of that is, I think one of the reasons they fail is the very first thing you asked me about was success is sequential, not simultaneous. And they set out to say, I'm going to get in great shape for bikini season, right?
Yeah.
And what they don't realize is they're taking on like five behaviors at once and they don't have the willpower to do them all.
Yeah.
So they want to eat differently, which means they have to shop differently and prepare their food differently and eat different portions, all of which could be their own habit, depending on who you are. And they're going to the gym, which means they have to go to bed earlier so they can get up earlier and then establish the routine of getting their clothes together so they can actually get out the door and make their class or whatever. And you're like, that's a lot. And if they just would narrow it down to one and do one at a time, they might look up by bikini season, have everything working for them, and really be feeling good about whatever, you know, for you and me, not bikinis, obviously, but whatever that bigger, larger goal was. So that's, you bring up resolutions and I have to go there. Goal setting to the now, which is where we want to go, is I think one of the biggest ideas buried in the book. And I didn't have as much exposure, even in the 4 or 5 years of research we did, to really, really high level thinkers. I mean, like the people who are, you know, making hundreds of millions of dollars a year, the people who are starting the foundations that are changing the world. But the more I have gotten to meet them, this is how they think. They get a vision of where they want to be in the future, and then they methodically work their way backwards so that what they're doing today, right, it could be a decade from their goal, is actually quite aligned to it. And that's a trick. That's a process.
Yeah.
So the research that kind of helps validate why having this process is there's this thing called hyperbolic discounting. And basically what it says is if I offered you $100 today or $200 tomorrow, everybody would say $200. But if I change the time frame, $100 today or $200 next year, almost everybody would take the $100.
Yeah.
It makes zero economic sense if all things are equal. Right. Because if I could double my money every year,
you know, why not? You got to do anything extra.
Right. But it's the time frame. And so what it tells us is the farther away a goal is, the less power it has over our action today. So we need to pull that vision of who we want to be and the company we want to have and the family we want to have closer and closer to us so that it has more power to actually get us to change our behavior. So the quick version is pick your goal, right? This is one that someone role modeled that we did an exercise in a class together. She wanted to be the main act at a jazz review, like singing jazz standards. That was her dream as a vocalist. And I said, great. So in order to achieve that goal, what's the one thing you would have to achieve in 5 years to feel like you were truly on track? So 5 years out. And she goes, well, to really be able to do that, you know, to do two sets, that's about 25 songs. I would have to know 25 amazing songs amazingly well. It's like, awesome. I have no idea if she's right or not, but it seems fairly precise.
Right.
And so you take that time frame. You've gone from someday to 5 years. Now we're going to go backwards. What's the one thing you would have to accomplish this year to feel like you're absolutely on track for that 5-year goal?
Yeah.
And, you know, what's nice about this, that 25, and I promise I'm not making that number up, that's what she threw out. It was very handsomely, easily divided by 5. She's like, well, I guess I'd have to be really awesome at 5 songs. It's like, makes sense to me. It's like, great. Right. So now we've pulled it back to 1-year time frame, which most of us kind of understand how to set goals in.
Right.
And the next question is, in order to feel like you are on track for your annual goal, what one thing would you absolutely have to have nailed this month to feel like you are on track for your annual goal? And she's like, well, I guess I would have to be already practicing one of the songs. Great. Well, what would you have to now do this week to feel like you were on track for your monthly goal? And I think it was like pick out the songs or find someone who could help her pick them out. I lose the details there. But then you go from the week to what do I have to do today to be on track for my week? And what do I have to do right now to be on track for my day? And so you're pulling the future into the present.
Yeah.
And it's remarkable how that exercise gives us more clarity. And even if our 5-year goal is wildly off, it's just inaccurate because we don't know. After a year of walking down that path, maybe less, you'll probably have a really good idea of what that should be and can course adjust.
You'll be able to kind of tweak that and pull it into focus.
Yeah, you will. You will. You will. I mean, what's the stat about, you know, the NASA launched, you know, Apollo launched to the moon? It was only like on course like 2% of the time.
Right.
Most great acts are about lots of course correction is my aha from that. And I think most of our lives will be too.
Absolutely.
But you have to work backwards so that today has meaning for that someday goal. Otherwise, that disconnect can be too strong for us.
That's huge. I love that. So have a big, giant, beautiful, grand vision of the future of what you want. And then think about what you need to do within the next 5 years to accomplish that. And then think about what you need to do within the next 3 to accomplish the 5. And then within the next 1 to accomplish the 3 monthly and then weekly and then to this day. Bam.
There you go.
I love it. I love it. So as we kind of wind down, one of the questions I always like to ask is, I always like to ask, what are your favorite books, especially authors? What are some of the books that you've read, both business and self-improvement, that have really had an influence on your life, Jay?
If you could see my office, I've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 bookshelves that are all brimming with books. I have a book problem. Okay.
It's better than a drug problem.
Yes. definitely am a believer in the habit of feeding my mind new ideas. Yeah. I'll give you, here's how I answer that question. I'm incapable of saying what my favorite book is. And my shelf, I've got a couple of shelves of my favorite books, but that'd be like 50. Mm-hmm. Let me tell you the four books. I have a shelf of books that I buy a lot of, then I give away to people. And so right now on that shelf, I've got Managing Oneself by Peter Drucker. Mm. It's a very short book that can help people get a better sense of what their strengths are so they can succeed at a higher level. It's old, it's decades old, but I found it to be incredibly relevant.
I was actually just listening to the, it's like a 45 minute Audible version I was listening to the other day.
It was a Harvard Press article that they just made into a book. And so Stephen Pressfield has a book called The War of Art.
Love it.
I'm a writer, but I've heard that it resonates with entrepreneurs all over. And it's just this battle daily. He calls it the resistance against doing what you know you need to do and how we all fight that. And it's very artfully done. There's a book by Adam Grant called Give and Take.
Wonderful book. And,
strategic giving is a big thing that I preach to entrepreneurs. And we, in our Keller Capital, we have a small private equity firm. You know, we try to encourage the people that work with us to think very early on about what foundation would benefit from their business, because if they can align those, they'll both benefit. There's a book called The Defining Decade by Dr. Meg Jay, and I give this to all of my young friends, and it's really about how that decade after college that a lot of people think is time for exploration and goofing off and partying, 75% of our wage increase in life happens between 25 and 35. The people we're most likely to marry happen between exiting college and age 30. So the people we hang out with matter, the jobs we do matter. There's just all this research that she's spent a career counseling people on how to, if you're not going to build actual capital in your career, you can still build identity capital, which is a whole new word that's entered my lexicon. You know, go volunteer, do something special so that when you do decide on your career path, they'll go, wow, you were volunteering in Africa? Tell me about that. You know, it's actually interesting. Being a barista at Starbucks is not. And so I love that book. I've given that book away dozens and dozens of times.
What was it called again? One more time?
The Defining Decade.
I like that.
And then I found myself patting myself on the back for some of the things I did in my late 20s and thinking, oh, crap, about others. and the last one is a book called The Creator's Code by Amy Wilkinson. It's just a solid kind of mental paradigm book for people who are trying to build big ideas and businesses.
Love it. Love it. And now on to the final question, Jay, which is the same question that I ask every single one of our guests here on the show. And that is, what does it mean to you specifically to lead a meaningful life?
I love the question. And I think you probably can write a great book of everyone's answers, unless they're all the same. Who knows? I think for me, a life of meaning is about service to others and making a contribution. So at the end of my life, I hope that it's not how many books I've sold or how many bestsellers. I think I will find it most meaningful to know that I've actually helped people. Gary and I both, I think, share that desire to write books that don't just change the way people think, but change the way they act so that it can make a real difference in their lives.
Yeah.
That service is a big one for me, and probably the memories that I make with the people I love most.
Love it. Love it. And finally, Jay, how can people connect with you if they'd like to learn more about you and your work?
I just say visit us at theonething.com, and that's the with the number one thing.com. I'm pretty accessible on my social media channels if people want to reach out. But we have all of our worksheets. We have other materials there. And you can also just check out the book if you haven't heard of the book.
Awesome. Awesome. And finally, Jay, just a quick thank you to you and Gary for just the contribution that you guys have made to this personal growth space. Because, I mean, the book itself, the one thing's had an impact on me, and I know it's had an impact on millions of other people. So just a just a thank you to both of you guys for writing the book.
Well, thanks a lot, Dean. It means a lot. And when you labor for 5 years on something, you never get tired of hearing that it actually was okay and it wasn't a tremendous waste of your life. So it's like, yay, it's working.
Yeah, it's working.
Because, you know, writers are neurotic people. We're always afraid that we've just made the worst mistake of our life. Every sentence was horrible. So it's great to hear that the opposite might be true. So thank you for that. That means a lot.
Absolutely. Thank you for being here, Jay. I appreciate it. And folks, for those of you listening, if you want the show notes for this episode, first off, go out and get The One Thing if you haven't already done so. If you want the show notes for this episode with Jay, you can get those over at meaningfulhq.com, and I'll link up all the resources and notes that we discussed in the show notes for this episode. And until next time, go out there every single day, folks, and live like you give a damn. It's Dean. Listen, I hope you enjoyed this episode of the podcast. If you found this episode inspiring, or if anything else you've heard on the show has helped you or made an impact on your life in any way, I'd really appreciate it if you showed me a little love with a quick review over on iTunes or on whichever podcast platform you tune into the show on. Every single review helps us reach and inspire more people to live like they give a damn. Listen, if you've got self-help questions of your own that you'd like me to answer live on the podcast, hit me up over at meaningfulhq.com. You can submit them over on the contact page, or you can just shoot your questions directly to me at questions@deanbakari.com. Thanks again so much for subscribing, sharing, and tuning into the show. I've said it before, I'll say it again. It's because of you and tens of thousands of other listeners from around the world tuning in every single week, week after week, day after day, that we are able to continue creating content to help you crush it and make an impact in your life and at work. So thank you for being part of this and continuing to share the podcast with your friends, your family, and anyone else you think it could help. Until next time, this is Dean Bakari telling you to go out there every single day and live like you give a damn.